Welcome to The Purposeful Investor, a podcast for successful families in search of true prosperity. And I'm your host, Aidan Wilkins. Thanks for joining us again on another episode of The Purposeful Investor. In today's episode, we'll be looking back at the first quarter of the calendar year and seeing how that's played out across markets, economies, and sort of what are the key themes been. And today, I'm lucky enough to be joined again by Capital Partners founder David Andrew. We've also got another special guest, so Nick Menegola. So you might have heard him do a bonus episode recently, but Nick's going to be with us in the studio today in his role and capacity as our investment coordinator. So thanks for joining us, gents.
Thanks very much, Aidan. Always good to be with you.
Excited to be here for my first one.
Yeah, indeed.
So to start off the podcast, Nick, just to give it a little bit of flavour, can you tell us what your role actually involves here at Capital Partners?
I'm working in a split role. So I spend about 3 days of my week working with clients in the advice side of things. And then I spend the other two thinking about investments and our client portfolios. And specifically at the moment, we're really looking into how do we deliver our portfolios more robustly so that every single client that comes in gets a similar outcome and they're getting the best outcome that they deserve.
And interestingly, Nick, I guess we're currently managing money because we've got about, you know, $1.7 billion of assets, but we're really mindful of the fact that we're going to be 2 and then 4 and then 10. So how are you thinking about that from an investment process point of view?
So we are, I'd say our systems today are really good, but we know that if we keep growing the way that we're growing, we need to upgrade them now to be ready for that growth so that we don't hit a wall and there's no growth issues. And so we're working on making our systems continue to work when we are that bigger size firm and allowing our advisors to focus on their clients and still be able to deliver a really systematic, reliable investment experience to more successful families.
Well, I got to say, I'm very pleased that you're thinking about that because I'm a client and I'm sure all our clients would want that too.
And for those who haven't met Nick, he excels when it's in the detail. So he loves going into that and he's a very good problem solver. So we've got the right person on board to deal with that.
Absolutely.
As always on this podcast, we start off with our little win of the week. So it can be something professional, personal, anything in between, but something that you can reflect back on and say, yep, this has been a good win this week. So Nick, since you're the guest, you can start us off today.
Right. So my little win, I've lived with my sister for the last few years and she recently moved out having bought her own home. And this week, my girlfriend organized for her to come over for dinner and it was really nice. It was good to just spend time with her and it's a little bit different when you're hanging out by choice as opposed to living together. And the fact that Georgia organized it, it felt really nice. It felt like, it felt like Georgia was really part of the family and I loved that.
Mm. It's the simple things in life that's sometimes the most pleasurable, right?
Yeah.
What did you cook, Nick?
Oh, I didn't cook.
enough said. I think, Aidan, that's a good segue to you.
So mine, I'm going to slightly bend the rules a little bit again. So I'm going to go a recommendation. And again, it's a TV show and one that I'd heard from a few people that are saying, you've got to watch this. And it's Shogun, which is on Disney Plus. And for those who haven't heard of it, it's not as extreme as Game of Thrones, but it's set in the early years of these Japanese lords all trying to sort of fight for power. And it's just, it's brilliant. So I've binge watched that on the weekend and really enjoyed it.
Was that set on the based on the George Clavell novel?
Yeah, it's based on the book, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. Great book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so my little win is a family one, as it often is. And my eldest and youngest son bought a house together a few years ago. And they've decided it's time to go their separate ways. Tim wants to buy in Sydney and Lockie wants to do his own thing, so that's cool. But they have done the most amazing job of renovating this house. And I guess that's how you learn skills in terms of handyman type skills. They've done an amazing job. It's now listed for sale and, they're hoping for a great outcome. But it's been a real family affair in terms of the reno. Mum's been on a paintbrush and doing the gardening and I've been doing my bit, so it's been fun. Cool.
Awesome. So in talking about the update for the quarter, what's happened in the first quarter of the year, it's actually interesting, Dave. I was thinking in preparation for this podcast, it does not feel long ago that you and I caught up to chat about what can we expect from 2024. And we're sort of already in this at the end of March, start of April. So today we'll be delving into a couple of topics and talking around what are the key discussion points sort of happening around the world coming out of client meetings. And then also a little bit more specifically, touching on which asset classes have performed well, what have share markets broadly done, and then delving a little bit more into our systematic investment approach. So to start off with, I think one of the key questions that has still been on everyone's mind, it's been on the news, is this talk around interest rates. So Nick, I might get you to talk to this. So what's broadly been happening across the world and across the RBA and the Fed with interest rates?
So not a lot has happened in terms of rates haven't moved for the last 3 months, and the Fed's on hold, the RBA's on hold, but around that, the commentary has changed a lot. And so we're going into 2024, a lot of the expectations were that the Fed would cut as early as March. There's these bond markets that predict the likelihood of rate cuts, and they were pricing in a 100% chance of a rate cut in the US as early as March. And that just hasn't happened. And as we get further into year, this narrative of higher for longer and that kind of thing is starting to reemerge. We had it in 2023 and it's come back in 2024. The US is still, the Fed was signaling three rate cuts in 2024, and they're still toying with that line, but they're starting to open up the possibility that it's less than three. In Australia, it's a similar story. There's a lot of wage pressure at the moment. So unemployment is at about 3.7%. The RBA wants to see that get to 4.5%. And so it feels like there's a really hot labor market and a semi-weak economy, and there's a disconnect. And so until we see inflation come back, rates are likely to stay where they are.
And there doesn't really, whilst inflation has come back from the really heady times, it's still well and truly running ahead of where central banks want it to be.
Yeah. And as recent as the March US numbers were an upside surprise. And so the Fed was expecting...
In a bad way.
Yeah. The Fed was expecting inflation of 3.4%, and it got 3.5%, and that might sound like a small difference, but just always an upside surprise adds a little bit of volatility to the market, and investors react to it because it means they're not they're missing something.
Yeah. Can we talk about housing prices?
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems that irrespective of the capital city market you're in, and also this is true in the United States from my reading, everyone was expecting the heat to come out of the property market because of higher interest rates, but it just doesn't seem to have made a difference at all.
No, I think one of the key things that's happening is the re-emergence of immigration into Australia, and there's so much demand for housing that new starts are down. So there haven't been as many new houses starting, and I had a number for this. I think there are about 90,000 less houses being built each quarter than the government wants to see. So it's a big gap.
Wow.
And we were talking to a client this week who works in the supply of building companies, and he's saying that there's a massive dip in the demand for the products that go into new housing. And so it's a real issue. There is a big gap between the houses Australia needs to build, and they are building, and that's seemingly what's pushing property prices to continue higher.
Higher for longer, indeed.
Yeah.
To give a few stats to sort of really illustrate that, I'm looking at some data from CoreLogic, a big property data provider. So in Perth, if we're looking at home, the 12-month increase has been 20%. Until the 8th of April in house prices. And if you compare that to sort of the combined five capital cities, it's still at 9.9%. But in Perth, it's been really, really strong. And it's playing out both in sort of the the buyer side, but also in rental prices. Mm-hmm. So in Perth, the average rent has gone up almost 14%, so 13.7% in the last year.
Yeah.
And the one that really, the stat that really shocked me as well is just how quickly properties are getting sold. So there's some statistics that sort of say, what's the average days that a property's on the market? And so this time last year in Perth, it was about 20 days. In February, it was 12, and now it's down to 8 days. So pretty much as soon as you list it, it's off the shelf within a week.
Wow. Hot muffins.
Yep. So, Nick, I want you to explain a topic that you listeners might hear a lot of in the news, or they might hear commentators say, and it's this idea of a hard versus a soft landing. And then what does that actually mean? And what can people do with that information when they hear it?
Yeah, sure. So a hard landing, by definition, is where the economy goes into recession. And a recession, the definition of recession, is 2 consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. A soft landing is where the central banks manufacture a slowdown of the economy without going into recession. And to put some color to that, so if we had 2 quarters where GDP growth was negative 0.1%, and then another quarter of negative 0.1%, we would be in hard landing territory.
A technical recession.
Technical recession. Uh-huh. If we had 0.1%, and then 0.1%, positive 0.1%, we are in soft landing. So people think of them as binary, and technically they are, but really it's a spectrum. And so it doesn't look likely that we're going to go into a deep, prolonged recession. So the hard landing narrative is almost, it's a bit overplayed because it's easy to explain. It's a sensationalist headline. But if the difference is like 0.2% of GDP growth, is not the be all and end all. It's really what's the outlook going forward, and hard landing versus soft landing is kind of just a label more than a reliable indicator of future economics.
So would your advice then be wary of the headlines?
Yeah, 100%.
Don't get too spooked by the headlines. Whilst that might be true, markets have also been really strong though.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're in, persistently high inflationary environment, not high, but persistent inflationary environment, that should tell us that consumers are struggling, because they're paying more for everything. And that should indicate a significant slowdown in the economy, and generally the share market would anticipate that, right? Because it's a forward indicator of economic activity. And yet we're seeing markets around the world being really strong.
Mm. Well, a question I always ask myself and I don't have an answer for is how far forward looking are markets?
Mm-hmm.
Like, have the markets already seen that there's a little slowdown coming, or maybe not so little, a slowdown coming, and gone past that and then looked out further? And that is what I would potentially argue is happening is that during 2022, we had a really bad year. Like, to put it in context, for a 60-40 portfolio, I think it was the third.
So 60% in shares, 40% in bonds.
Yeah. Yep. It was the third worst year of total returns in history of the share market. It was terrible.
Wow.
And so you could argue that 2022 was factoring in what is essentially going on now, and now the share markets are looking past this slowdown in economic growth to what happens next.
I know some of our listeners who are clients will remember back to their, progress meetings and looking at their portfolios and, what were some of the returns looking like back then?
Well, in 2022, we had negative 20% equity returns, but then the really difficult bit was that we had negative bond returns as well, and it's the combination of the two, and we haven't seen it for about 30 years. I think
it's only happened twice in my whole career.
Yeah.
And that's a long time.
Yeah. And so it was really hard to have conversations about then about portfolios then, because the defensive component had fallen. But it feels like now is the time to just, I was thinking about it, just almost enjoy the bull run for a little bit. Mm. Like, don't get too caught up in the news and just take the good returns while you've got them, because.
But acknowledging that at some point.
It could change.
You'll be giving some back.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
in the last 4 years, so going back to 2020, we have had two negative 20% corrections in equity markets. On average, that happens once every 6.5 years. So we have had a particularly volatile time in the last few years of equity markets. And so sitting and enjoying when it goes well is sometimes actually just a really healthy thing to do.
Yeah. And Aidan, I'm interested in your thoughts on this because you're in a lot more client meetings than I am, and both of you are, in fact. And are you still getting that sense from clients of, you know, oh, gee, the world feels really risky at the moment? There's a lot going on.
Yeah, I think it's like that quote that we always say, there's always a reason not to be investing in the news cycle or out there. But I think what we've really tried to do with clients, particularly over the last 18 months, is have that expectations conversation around returns and sort of saying, look, there is going to be periods where your portfolio does fall by a certain percent, but that's factored into the plan. And so then when we have these nice periods over the last 12 months where you can enjoy the uplift, we've sort of had that conversation. We're saying, look, things are really good now, but just know there is going to be a point when they do turn, we factored it in and you're going to be okay. So I think it's a really important part of the advice relationship.
Yeah. And you know what? I came across an amazing little graph the other day, and it was talking about the stock market return, which is what on average for the last 50 years, about 11% per annum. Yeah. So the average return from the stock market over the last 50 years, let's say it's 11% per annum. In that only happened, like the average was delivered 3 times in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
So only on 3 occasions did the actual return look anything like 11%. It was either way, way more or it was way, way less.
Yep.
And obviously there are double the number of great years than there are boring years.
Mm.
So fascinating where we all have this expectation of a consistent return from the market, and yet the data just tells a different story completely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a similar one, the one I seem to see popping up at the moment is people are saying that because we have had such a good last 12 months, the next 12 months have to be bad. Like it's almost you get one and give one. But it's typically not like that, in that just because we've had a bad year doesn't mean that next year is going to be just because we've had a good year doesn't mean that the next year isn't going to also be a good year. There's some data that suggests that good years tend to cluster. And even just, we expect the market to go up about 75% of the time and 25% of the time it will fall. And so just assuming that because the last 12 months were great, that the next 12 months won't be great doesn't really match up with what history says.
Yeah. But statistically, the reverse is true, that if you have a terrible year,
yeah,
most people think, oh, this is really scary.
Yep.
It's going to continue to be terrible.
Yep.
But what actually happens?
Well, after a fall is almost the best time to be invested. Everything's on sale. Like if you wanted to buy something from David Jones, you want to do it when the sale's on, not when we're at full price.
Yeah.
And so,
But in terms of investor behavior, that's so counterintuitive, because I don't want to be investing my life savings when it's scary. I want to be investing my life savings when it feels great.
Yeah. And I heard someone say that the biggest risk to their financial future is bad advice from their friends and family. And when markets are falling, what do people talk about? Like people talk about how scary it is, and that just the general sentiment grows, and you get so many feedback loops from friends, family, news, that kind of thing. And it can be really hard just to block it out and just not go, no, I know that this is going to happen. We expected this. We didn't know what was going to be pushing it down, but we knew it was going to go down at some point, and I just need to ride it out. And so,
and for our clients, most importantly, and I have a plan that's been built to take account of exactly this thing happening.
Yeah. And so it's really hard to almost, like everyone wants to try and predict what's going to happen next, and it's fun to talk about, but just to accept that we don't really know, it's a much easier way to live with a portfolio than try and outguess what's coming next.
Yeah. So given that we're looking at the quarter results, what have markets done for the last quarter? Not so much for the last quarter. I'm not bothered about short-term returns, but for the year ending the 31st of March, what happened?
Mm. Returns have been very good, in short, to start with. So internationally, it's up about 25% for the 12 months to the end of March. In Australia, we're up about 15%. Bonds have been starting to generate returns in line with what you'd expect bonds to do. So if you look at longer dated bonds, it's about 4.5% for the last 12 months. If you look at a little bit shorter dated bonds, which are similar to cash and term deposits, you're looking at about 3.8%. Some of the more fun ones I like to follow out of interest more than anything. Gold is up about 18.5% for the last 12 months, which is for a store of wealth and an asset that doesn't generate an income is very high. And Bitcoin is up 150% on 12 months.
Load up on those Bitcoin. that's got to be a good place to be.
What about shorter term? What about for the quarter?
Yep. So internationally, we had about 13.4% for the last 3 months. Australia is up about 5.9%. Longer dated bonds, interestingly, are down for the quarter very slightly. So they're down about 0.1%. And that's
the canary saying interest rates are going to be higher for longer.
Yeah. And the market had priced in reduction in interest rates, and the way bonds work is when interest rates fall, their value increases.
Sure.
And so because markets were expecting rates to get cut in March and they didn't, then they were pricing in the existing bond to be more attractive than future bonds, and when that didn't happen, the price of existing bonds just fell slightly. And so it's not a major shift, like it's 0.1%, but it was. That's just the connection between interest rates and bond returns.
How much of that international share return, Nick, is being driven by the US and in particular the S&P 500?
Yeah, the US has been driving it, in particular the Magnificent Seven or four. But
can you just remind us of the Magnificent Seven? What are we talking there?
So the Magnificent Seven is Tesla, Apple, Alphabet or Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta or Facebook, and Nvidia. So they're the big seven tech companies in the US, and I think their return represents 75% of the total S&P return over the last 12 months. It is an astonishing number.
So seven stocks are responsible for 75% of the return of the entire S&P 500.
It is outrageous. And to put in context, these companies, their combined market cap is, I don't have the exact data in front of me, but I think their combined market cap is bigger than the UK, France, and I can't remember the third country combined. Like they are bigger than
like
countries.
Germany, maybe.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is. So people, I feel like they get talked about a lot, and people sometimes go like, how important are these actually? But they really are that important because they are that big, that they do really have a big impact on what happens in the world and what happens in returns. And so talking about them is, I guess, fair.
I think there's an interesting angle here because when this business started nearly 25 years ago, the first 3 years or so were the lead up to what's now colloquially referred to as the tech wreck.
Mm.
And I know there were people when sort of the market readjusted and the bubble burst, if you will, to use again, you know, the metaphor, there were people who said, oh, I'm never investing in the tech market again. It's speculative. It's a casino. But back in 2000, online shopping was just a pipe dream. Mm. The internet and payment systems were just emerging. Mm. And all of the architecture that is so fundamental to the way our economy runs today was born essentially in that first tech boom. So if you had said, okay, there was a tech bust and I hate tech stocks and I'm not investing in them, you'd have left a lot of money on the table, mm-hmm, between then and now. And I think the same thing holds true now, that if there is a sell-off in tech stocks, what is going on now, particularly in the AI space, particularly in renewable energy, is they are the foundation stones for the future of our economy. Do you have a view on that?
I do. I think that is likely true. But by the same token, it doesn't mean that you should go all in on them. Mm. And I find that that's the question we get more than we get asked more, should I have more of these tech companies?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So I'd be thinking, should I be underweight? Should I be selling some of these and de-weighting, which essentially is what we're doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in our portfolios, we kind of take an approach that they are so big and so important, you cannot ignore them. So you have to hold some of them. But by the same token, for Google to double in size versus Capital Partners as an example, it'll be so much harder for Google to double in size just purely based on how big it already is. And so the risk is a tiny bit asymmetric in that its upside doesn't seem quite as high as its potential downside. Like, and there's plenty of examples of massive companies failing. Like, we look at General Electric, which price fell from $250 to $31 in a few years. We look at Alcoa that fell from $91 to $23. There's big companies fail, and so you don't want to go all in on them just because they're big. And there's that narrative of, I should hold a blue chip portfolio. And yes, they're important and you need to hold them. You can't solely rely on them because they are big. Too big to fail got proved in 2009 that it's not true. Lehman Brothers collapsed.
And along with others. Yeah, interesting perspective.
What Nick sort of alluded to there is actually what we're thinking through for another podcast topic in terms of the agony and the ecstasy of stock picking, in terms of how hard, even with really big blue chip diversified companies, there's so many stories like Nick alluded to, where wealth has been destroyed from having too high a concentration. So a little bit of an insight into a future topic there, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Where I would like to move to now, so as all of our clients and listeners will likely know, we have a really systematic, evidence-based investment approach here at Capital Partners. And so Nick's given some insight into how the broader market's done. But we build portfolios that are diversified, and we also tilt the portfolios towards and smaller companies and have a profitability overlay. So how's the performance of those played out in the past 12 months, Dean?
Yeah, sure. They've been quite good in the last few months. So if we look at Australian value, so that has returned about 15.4%. So it's slightly up on just a traditional portfolio of which it returned 14.9%. Similarly, the small premium in Australia did quite well and it returned 18.2% over the last 12 months. Internationally, a similar story. So we saw international value return 27% versus the traditional benchmark of 25.8. The small underperformed a little bit, and that is that would be largely driven by those magnificent seven, those big companies, because a portfolio that targets small companies obviously has a lower weighting to those massive companies. So that would have formed some of that gap in 2022 when those companies weren't doing so well. That was a massive positive, and it's going to chop and change every year. And this is just one of those years where it didn't play out.
What's interesting about that insight though, is you talk about NVIDIA being, I think that's been the highest return on the market of any stock. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's up 230% over the last 2 years, and it's 88% financial year to date, calendar year to date, sorry.
But our systematic structured approach means that our clients had an exposure to NVIDIA when it was a small company.
And we recently got, we were speaking to the fund manager, and they gave us an example of that systematic approach with these big companies. And one of the examples they gave was Meta or Facebook in 2022. Because I'm not sure if everyone remembers, but in 2022, Meta was going through the privacy scandal and its share price tanked. So it fell tanked is probably too strong a word, but it fell significantly, and it was valued at about $90 in 2022, and its earnings to price multiple was single digits. It's for a tech company of that size is outrageous. And so because it seemed relatively like a value company at that time, the fund manager started to increase their weight of Meta. So the company fell, they increased their weight because of their systematic approach, and it seemed more of a value company. And then it started to grow and the price recovered because as the market often does, it realized that it overreacted. Its price grew and then it got to the point where it was back to being a growthy company. And so they started to reduce their holding back to kind of about where it is now.
Yeah. And that's how we harvest those returns from value in small stocks. Mm-hmm. You know, small stocks become big stocks, so they have to be sold out of the small stock portfolio.
Yep.
Value companies recover, so they have to be, you know, the price goes up so much that they have to be sold out of the value portfolio.
Yeah,
there still might be big stocks, but there's a, and there's none of this, the beauty of this approach is none of it's speculative. Mm. It's a systematic, looking at the prices of every single stock every single day, looking at how they rank against other similar type stocks. And we get to harvest those higher expected returns, which is really cool.
Mm. And I love that story because it reaffirms to me that there's so much happening in the portfolio every single day. And it's just a good reminder that you might see one line on your performance reports, but there is so much happening and there's so much thought and systematic approaches to how they choose what they include and what they don't. And so, I really like that story.
Cool.
Yeah, so I think it's to round out the conversation. So generally, it's been a strong start to the year on markets. And like Nick said before, if we had over 20% returns in 2023, some people might think, oh, we're doomed for a bad year in 2024. We might have negative returns, but it's actually started really, really strong. And that's why we always echo the sentiment of don't try and pick the tops and the bottoms. Don't try and get in and out of the market, because what the evidence has shown is that where you take this long-term approach, you really do benefit from strong returns. So is there anything you would like to leave our listeners with in terms of what they can expect from the year ahead, or any messages that you want our clients to take on board, Nick?
Can I ask you a question on that? I want to know what's going to happen in another Trump presidency. I'm only kidding. I'm too terrified to even contemplate it.
What would I expect in the next 12 months? I don't really know in terms of what's going to happen in markets. I know that we are going to have, typically in the lead up to an election, there is a little bit more volatility. There's no data to suggest that, say, Democratic versus Republican is one is good for the market and the other isn't. And there's no data to suggest that markets do particularly well in election years or particularly poorly in election years. So there's no long-term trends to be played in election years, but there typically is a little bit more volatility leading up to. So I'd probably expect a bit of that. There's still obviously conflict in the Middle East and between Ukraine and Russia. And so there'll be moments in the year where that has big impacts on the market, like we've seen in the last 3 months. So since the start of the year, the oil price, the crude oil price is up about 20%. And most of that is supply concerns because I think as recently as last week, there was an attack on a Ukrainian oil reserve. And so there's going to be moments in the year where things are happening and it's scary. We don't know what it's going to do for markets. And so follow the news if you enjoy it. And if you like it, you don't need to. And while it's going well, kind of just take it and enjoy it is, I guess, that's what I'd encourage our clients to do.
A client many years ago said, obviously you asked the question, you know, what are you thinking about markets at the moment? And the response was, you know, David, I'm paying you to worry about this stuff. When the markets are good, I go to the golf course. When the markets are bad, I go to the golf course. That's a really smart way to look at it, i.e., you know, metaphor for get on with your life and enjoy it. And I made the point earlier
And I know that Robin and I derive enormous comfort from this as clients, that our plan has actually been built and stress tested, and behind the scenes there are fire drills run on our portfolio to make sure that even if there's a wobble, and sometimes there's a tough wobble, a bad wobble, we're very high probability of still being on track. Mm. And I love that. And I know Robin really enjoys that sense of not certainty, because there's no real certainty in the world. You know, tomorrow the sun's going to come up, and that's about the only certainty we've got. But the thought that goes into building the portfolios and the thought that goes into building the cash flows and the financial plans certainly gives us a lot of comfort.
And that's a great note to close out on. And I would encourage our listeners that if there's anyone that you think would enjoy the podcast, feel free to share it with them, leave a review. And also, if you've got any questions or topics that you'd like us to explore in a little bit more detail, please feel free to send them through to myself, David, or the podcast email address, which is ask@capital-partners.com.au. Nick, David, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Aidan.
Thanks, Aidan.
We love being able to share our insight and guidance. So if you know someone in your community that may enjoy our podcast, please share it with them. As always, we encourage all of our listeners to share their questions and ideas that they would like to know more on. You can email us at ask@capital-partners.com.au. That's ask@capital-partners.com.au. David Andrew and myself, Aidan Wilkins, are authorised representatives of Capital Partners Private Wealth, ABN 27086 670788, AFSL 227148. Thank you, and see you next time.